I'm Marty Moskowain. We're having an adult conversation on Radio Times today, not appropriate for children. There's an enduring stereotype about sex, that men are hardwired to play the field to seek out new and different partners, while women are security seekers who want commitment and emotional connection from their intimate relationships. New research is challenging some of these gender stereotypes and exploring what really and literally turns women on. Daniel Bergner writes about these studies and their findings in his new book, What Do Women Want? Adventures in the Science of Female Desire. He talked with psychologists and behavioral scientists, sexologists, and women about the female experience of sex. He's a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, author of several other books, including The Other Side of Desire. And Daniel Bergner, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be with you.
You know, I doubt a book has ever been written with the title, What Do Men Want?
And
there's no mystery there, is there?
There may be more subtlety and mystery than we give men credit for, but for the moment anyway, the sort of fascinating set of questions surrounds, I think, women's sexuality, and that's why I went on this journey. And as you mentioned, one of the preconceptions that we've been living under has been this idea put forth most recently by evolutionary psychologists that while men are programmed genetically to spread their seed, their cheap, limitless seed, and thus to be promiscuous, that relatively speaking, women seek out one good man and are thus relatively well suited to monogamy. Well, science is giving us a new and I think ultimately empowering picture of women's sexuality.
And I do want to pick up on that. What is your particular interest in this subject matter?
So this is the second book I've written about desire. The Other Side of Desire was the first. And in the process of researching for that book, I sort of stumbled into the lab of Meredith Chivers, who's a fascinating Canadian researcher looking into women's sexuality. And spending time with her, I began to see kind of societal blinders coming off, assumptions being shaken. And in fact, she would later say, I, Meredith, feel like I'm shaking the foundations of the way we think about women's sexuality. Now, that could sound arrogant. I think in her case, it was quite accurate. And of course, I wanted to stay with her and with other scientists on that journey.
Well, I'm very happy to say that she joins us. Meredith Chivers joining us on Radio Times. She's a clinical psychologist, associate professor at Queen's University, where her work focuses on the treatment of sexual functioning problems, gender and sexual identity concerns, sexual addiction, and atypical sexual interests. And Meredith Chivers, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you, Marty. It's wonderful to be here.
Well, it's nice to have you with us as well. And I was talking a bit with Daniel Bergner, and I said as a kind of a joke to get the conversation started that I've never seen a book about what do men want. As someone who does research on sexuality, is it harder to try to understand female sexuality?
No, I don't think that it's harder to understand female sexuality. I think that the balance of research that has been done over, you know, say, the past three decades since Masters and Johnson, when I came on the scene, seemed to come from a perspective where male and female sexuality were seen as somewhat, you know, opposite sides of the same coin. And myself, along with many other influential researchers, were beginning to question that assumption and whether these models of sexual arousal and desire, models of sexual orientation, whether these models really fit to explain what we were observing with women's sexuality. And ultimately, you know, the research that I do, we're interested in understanding female sexuality from a woman's perspective.
Well, let me talk a bit about some of the research that you do, because first of all, it's a very interesting approach to try to understand female sexuality, having to do, I guess, with what their bodies are saying and what they are reporting. Can you describe, I guess, in the most basic terms, how your research works?
Absolutely. So we have what we call a sexual psychophysiology laboratory. And so what that means is we bring people into our lab, both women and men, and we measure their physical responses to sexual stimuli. So we use devices that measure changes in their genitals. So as women experience vulvar engorgement and vaginal lubrication, and as men experience penile erections. We measure these with devices, and we also ask these people to report how they're feeling in a number of ways. And they watch a variety of different kinds of sexual stimuli. So in my lab, we're interested in understanding how people's self-reported attractions map onto their responses in the laboratory. And so we would show people, for example, things that correspond with what they're sexually attracted to. So, for example, we have a lesbian woman come in and watch sexual films of women and men and see whether her patterns of response match her stated sexual attraction to women.
Well, and I guess in a nutshell, if I can say that, what you found with women was an interesting kind of disconnect between how their body was responding to these images and what they reported.
Absolutely. So when I started doing this research as a graduate student at Northwestern University, I was initially very interested in this question of how women's sexual orientation mapped onto their responses in the laboratory. And I have followed that line of research since the late 90s. And what we found is that sort of the most unusual group are heterosexual women, that among heterosexual women, they seem to show a pattern of physical response to a really broad array of sexual stimuli. So films depicting men, depicting women, whereas they report that they're feeling sexually aroused predominantly by the male stimuli. Women who are same-sex attracted, so for example, lesbian women, tend to show a pattern that seems to be more congruent with their stated sexual attraction.
Hmm.
So that's sort of one piece of the puzzle. As I continued to do this research, it became apparent that this pattern fit with a broader finding in this field of sexual arousal research, where there seemed to be a lower agreement between the physical responses that women experienced in the laboratory and how turned on they reported that they felt. And so this agreement seemed to be lower than what we saw with men. And so I had conducted something called a meta-analysis, which is a quantitative review of the literature to begin to understand what factors might be at play. And what we found was really interesting that, like I said, on average, women tend to show this lower agreement between mind and body than men do. But we also saw tremendous variation among women in that mind-body agreement, which suggested that other factors were in play.
Well, let me get you back in on the conversation, Daniel Berger. As you were telling me, even before we began this interview, it was Meredith Shivers' research that really got you interested in this issue of, I guess, desire and arousal.
Right. So it was Meredith's lab where my journey for this book really began, and it was with that gap between what women were saying turned them on versus what their bodies were saying. And certainly, as I think Meredith will emphasize, it's the idea is not that the body speaks entirely for desire, that the body speaks some absolute capital T truth of desire. But certainly what I was inferring from Meredith's research was that we were missing something as a culture. We were looking right past possible truths about women and desire. And so I then continued following Meredith's research closely with great fascination and branching out with other scientists and then interviewing scores of women. And what I kept coming up against was the realization that that old trope, that old idea, you know, male promiscuity, females relatively well suited to monogamy, really was, well, first of all, based on some quite flimsy evidence, I think, and circular reasoning when I went back to look at the original papers. And then when I saw the science that was being conducted by Meredith and others, I really thought assumptions were being turned upside down by science that's being conducted currently.
But are you saying that women are more like the stereotype of men than the stereotype of women?
Well, one, you know, some people have suggested to me that what the book communicates is that women are men, or men are women, or we're all human beings, and that may
well... Or this is a male fantasy of women.
Well, that's, I suppose, the risk. There are two risks in my, as a man, writing this book. One is that this is some version, my concocted version of Girls Gone Wild, right? That's problem, potential problem number one. And the other is that I, as a man, am going to be sort of foolish or arrogant in proclaiming, being one more in a long line of men proclaiming about women's desire. I'm going to let go. This really, in as much as it may be a male fantasy, it's also a tremendous male fear. And I think that's that sort of the fragile male ego and the threat to men is significant, and I think ultimately informs that evolutionary psychology perspective that we were referring to earlier. The second issue, though, is serious, the man proclaiming on women's desire. And I hope that I've gotten past that simply by doing 8 years of intense listening, listening in labs, listening to scientists, listening to everyday women.
Well, let me go back to you, Meredith Chivers. As someone that does this research, then how do you understand what appears to be a bit of a disconnect? You're showing these images to women, and what they're reporting, I guess on they're using iPads or writing down, what they're reporting doesn't seem to connect with the bodily response they're having to these images.
So I think the unsatisfying answer at this point is that we don't understand exactly why there is this disconnect. But certainly the research that I'm conducting, that others are conducting, is trying to shed some light on what might be the factors that are at play in beginning to explain this this variability in the mind-body connection for women. So, you know, one perspective that I've written and others have written about is the possibility that the physiological responding is sort of an automatic protection of the body during sexual activity. And so when women see something that is sexual, so stimulus is processed very, very quickly, you know, below awareness, and this initiates a physiological response which leads to changes in the vagina that cause vaginal lubrication. And this physiological response, much like how, you know, we salivate when we smell food, we don't necessarily want to eat the food, and I'm sure there's vegetarians out there who will report salivating to the smell of bacon at times, but that it's, you know, it's all part of a physiological response to protect the body, you know, in the case of food, with swallowing and digestion, in the case of vaginal responding, perhaps to reduce the amount of injury and trauma if a woman is forced into penile-vaginal intercourse. So that's one perspective, that this is, you know, this disconnect between mind and body is a sort of, from an evolutionary biology perspective, a protective mechanism.
Well, you know what? Hold on to that thought, only because we have to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Meredith Chivers. She's a clinical psychologist, associate professor, Queen's University, and her work, very interesting research that she has done on sex and sexual functioning and women and men. And joining us also and here with us in our Philadelphia studios is Daniel Bergner, contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, author of a new book called What Do Women Want? Adventures in the Science of Female Desire. His book, in part based on Meredith Chivers' research. Stay with us. Call us 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hello, I'm Russell Kaufman, president of the Wistar Institute, a proud supporter of WHYY. For over 100 years, Wistar scientists have helped keep your families, friends, and employees healthy because of our research that guides the creation of early-stage drugs. We then work with the pharmaceutical industry for their final production. Our name may not be on these cancer drugs, but our fingerprints are all over them. To learn more about how Wistar keeps you healthy and our region economically strong, online at wistar.org.
Next time in Studio 360... With our Battle of the High School Bands in full swing, we'll listen to some of your entries with our judge, Andrew W.K.
You've been accompanying Wachovia Bank Robbers on the air drums.
It's my go-to air instrument, more than guitar and more than vocals.
The music you made in high school. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, 50 years on and there's still no moss on the Rolling Stones, we'll speak with one of their biggest fans about the songs that tell their story. Next time on Here and Now, from NPR and WVUR Boston.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about what women want. And I should say, Daniel Bergner, our guest here in our Philadelphia studios, who's a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, author of a new book called What Do Women Want? And on the telephone is Meredith Shivers, and she is a researcher, and much of her work appears in Daniel Bergner's book, which is why we wanted to have them together with us on Radio Times for an adult conversation about sexual desire and arousal. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Daniel, if I can just go back to you and something you were saying earlier, which was you wanted to challenge some of these evolutionary ideas about, you know, men sort of wandering the world, spreading their seed, women staying home and taking care of the children. Do you think, I mean, in certain ways, there's, I think, a bit of a truth to that, because it has to do with survival, yes? Survival of the human species.
Well, it's interesting. Does it have to do with survival? So many possible places to begin, but let's just begin with one obvious one. That theory, and it is a theory, mm-hmm. is very comforting to me as a man and very soothing to society that half the population is sort of genetically predisposed, at least, to serve as a kind of social backbone or social glue to hold us all together. It's not at all clear, in fact, that that paradigm, that dichotomy, is the most advantageous to our survival. In fact, there's strong research to indicate that female promiscuity might be most advantageous to survival for a couple of reasons. One, in our close primate ancestors, it masked paternity, that is, it made unclear who the father is and thus prevented infanticide by primate fathers. Mm-hmm. Another, that it might allow for more advantageous sperm, and so healthier offspring, more likely to thrive. So you can construct these arguments in all kinds of ways. And it's important, I think, to look at, again, what current science is showing about patterns of desire, Meredith's research among that science, in order to sort of take the blinders off and get a closer look. Two things to just quickly point out, sure, just by way of some of many examples. I think one thing that Meredith's research certainly shows, as does research coming out of other labs, is that old idea that men are somehow more visual sexually is really, again, very comforting for me, but something we've got to let go of, and in a way, part of the package of that evolutionary psychology notion of male promiscuity and women somehow more civilized in their sexuality. One other just quick example. The book is 90% about women, but I did spend some time in a primate research center, probably the most prominent one in the States. And it's fascinating. Until very recently, scientists believed, and we believed, that female monkeys, passive males, the aggressors in monkey politics, monkey war, and monkey sex. Well, take the preconceptions off, look carefully. Females are doing the sexual, chasing, stalking. They're the sexual predators. They're the aggressors in war. And perhaps most amusing of all, primatologists have to cycle out, get rid of the male monkeys from their compounds. Wow. Because the females get too bored to have sex with them. So,
well, and let me underscore that. You talk about these are female rhesus monkeys run the sexual show. Those are your words.
Yes, and in fact, it was female rhesus monkeys who we sent into orbit in the 50s and 60s as our astronaut doubles. But it took us a long while, perhaps now finally, to learn some sexual truths as well as some astronaut truths from them.
Meredith, let me go back to you. I mean, would it be helpful to look at how lesbians behave with each other to help us understand what women want? Is that helpful research?
That has been suggested by some. So if you sort of remove men from the equation altogether, are you going to get sort of a pure representation of women's sexuality? And I think we have to remember that, you know, lesbian relationships occur within a socio-cultural and political context as well, and those are factors that can influence how women express their sexuality. And so I think it's always important to remember those that environment or context within which people's sexuality is playing out. Now, if I could return to an earlier point when we were talking about this mind-body divide, you know, so I talked about an evolutionary biology or psychology perspective. You know, another way to look at this has to do with how women are taught about their bodies and about their sexuality, and that, you know, a history filled with negative messages about what women's vulvas look like, that they're not attractive, that this is associated with shameful things like menstruation, that women shouldn't have sexual feelings or masturbate. I mean, these are all messages that serve to divorce women from their physical sexuality. And so I think it's very important for us also, and you know, I'm working with a team of researchers to examine these questions as well, as sort of how do these sociocultural forces and gender stereotypes about sexuality influence the way that women experience their arousal and desire.
Well, it's interesting. Now, Daniel Bergner talked about Girls Gone Wild. I was thinking of the HBO show Girls and even the popularity of 50 Shades of Grey. Do you think, Meredith, that women are sort of changing in their either expression, understanding, acceptance of their bodies and their sexuality?
I think there's absolutely a movement afoot whereby there is much more open dialogue for, you know, coming from women talking about openly about their sexual desires, their feelings, you know, demystifying their experiences of their genitals, and you know, trying to sort of reclaim what I think for a lot of women has felt like a separation from an aspect of their self that's incredibly important, their sexuality.
Well, you know, in your book, you quote a guy, William Acton, I guess he was a British gynecologist, who said, this is a quote here, "The majority of women happily for society are not very much troubled by sexual feeling of any kind."
Right. So William Acton, a Victorian era gynecologist and very prominent medical writer of his time. The question then is, how far have we come from the Victorian age? And in some ways, very, very, very far. I mean, look around us, look at billboards, look at, we're living in a basically sex-saturated society, certainly a seemingly sexually unrestrained society. But then the question, as Meredith was just alluding to, is what are the subtler messages that we give to boys and girls, to men and women about their sexuality? And still, I think there is a tremendous divide, though it may be more difficult to recognize now. You know, the following is a bit of a cliche, but sometimes it's worth just dwelling on cliches because they're so indicative of kind of prevalent forces in our culture. So my daughter is about to turn 21. We live in a very liberal Brooklyn neighborhood. However, she can still recount sort of slut-shaming episodes. That's still a term of art in her world. There is no such thing as stud-shaming, for sure. And just that division just gives you a sense we are still living in a divided world, I think, when it comes to male and female sexuality.
Let me just reintroduce the two of you, and that's Daniel Bergner, our guest today on Radio Times. He's a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, author most recently of What Do Women Want? Adventures in the Science of Female Desire. And one of the researchers he interviewed is joining us by telephone, Meredith Shivers, clinical psychologist, associate professor at Queen's University. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. This is an issue I want to be super careful about because this has to do with rape fantasies. And it's obviously a very fraught thing to talk about. But since you're with us, Meredith, and I'm curious about how we should understand what those fantasies are about and what it says about women and their sexuality.
Well, I think that Dan did a very nice job in his book of sort of positioning rape fantasy within the, you know, the fantasy life of women as not being about wanting actual rape. Rape in itself is a violent act, is a coercive act. And by definition, if a woman is in control of her fantasies, she is in control of the sexual scenario. And so it by definition cannot be rape. I think that, you know, the prevalence of them suggests that there is something quite powerful about submitting to the will of another person and being overcome. And so I understand how challenging it is to talk about this, especially for women who have experienced rape, to imagine using that kind of imagery as, you know, fodder for sexual fantasy for some as anathema. In another one of Dan's books, however, The Other Side of Desire, he interviewed a woman who talked about, Dan, I believe it was incest fantasies that she had in achieving orgasm. And so, you know, there's a certain degree to which, you know, there's a boundaries that do get crossed. And I think, you know, part of what these kinds of fantasies of being overcome and coerced are about is turning up the degree of sexual excitement, sort of dialing up the arousal level, and that for some people they seek out these sexual stimuli that are verboten and taboo as a way to heighten their sexual experience.
And the important thing to say is this is a fantasy. This is not...
Absolutely.
Right. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, it's important to underline at the outset of this conversation, no one is backing even half an inch away from no means no. That's absolutely essential, and it's essential to separate the world of fantasy and what I think it does show about our psychologies, about desire. But desire does not mean necessarily wanting something to actually happen. Our lives are filled with things we might fantasize about sexually and otherwise that we do not want. So it's important to say that. I don't think it's a coincidence that this part of the book wound up right in the middle. It was the most difficult for me to write. I knew I wanted to think past politics in a way so that I could stay in the psyche. That was really important to me. But it was a very... I struggled with it. I think Meredith's pointing out a great explanation, an important one, which is the excitement of taboo. Taboo, of course, also kind of alleviates responsibility. I think it's a way for some to allow their sexuality to speak to them without feeling responsible for it. And also then researcher, therapist Marta Mayana sort of introduced into our conversation the powerful idea of being desired and the desire to be desired, and that spark being particularly strong for some women. Mm-hmm. And of course, fantasies of being overpowered involve fantasies of a man, often a man, wanting you uncontrollably.
And Meredith, I mean, it just needs to be said only because we're down here in the United States, and it was about a year or two ago that Todd Akin talked about, you know, legitimate rape and the body shutting that whole thing down. And again, anytime you talk about these kinds of fantasies, I just need to make sure that we can sort of put the brakes on the threat and dangerousness and crime, frankly, of legitimate rape.
Absolutely. I mean, I could, I won't offer commentary at this point on these kinds of quotes. I mean, they're certainly atrocious and misinformed about women's sexuality and physiology. But again, I want to echo what Dan has said, that what happens in fantasy life doesn't mean that people want this to play out in actual life.
Yeah, did you want to add something, Dan?
I was just thinking, when you talked about that notion, idiotic notion, that somehow a woman raped could not conceive it, it's part of a long line of sort of physiological clueless misconceptions. You know, from classical Greek times till around, loosely speaking, the 1700s, scientists were certain that female orgasm was actually required for conception. Now, that's part of a long and fascinating story that I tell in the book about our ideas of female desire. But yes, that most recent iteration of just nonsense kind of fits into that history.
Let me get some callers. And it looks like we have Gunther from Princeton joining us on Radio Times. And Gunther, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, Marty. Hi there. Great show. I really appreciate the topic.
No problem.
This is more of a comment than anything else, I guess. I'm no sex expert, but I'm certainly experienced. What I wanted to suggest is that years ago, Rutgers had a big program on human sexuality, and I participated with that. And what I came away with from that was that the sexual drive in people, in men and women, is comparable to Niagara Falls. You know, it ranks right up there with, you know, survival and eating. And regardless of the cultural overlay that we have about men and women, that women should be reticent and men should be this, is that both males and females want to reproduce, and the drive to do that is not going to be hindered. It's not going to be stopped. Cultural overlay is small by comparison to that drive, and I think we should keep that perspective. Now, maybe it was said earlier. I came to your program later.
That's okay, Gunther. No, I appreciate that, the call to Radio Times. And Meredith, since we're going to lose you in just a couple of minutes here, I'd be curious about your response. Is it about reproduction, or is it about something more than that?
Well, I don't think that reproduction is foremost in people's minds when they're feeling desire of wanting to have sex. I mean, certainly people do have procreative sex to conceive, but, evolutionary psychology operates with the premise that, you know, there are these aspects to our behavior that have been shaped by selection, you know, our ability to reproduce, but we don't experience them as foremost in our motivation. So it's, of course, a very strong drive. It's necessary to, you know, perpetuate our species. I thank you for Gunter's comment. Sure. I wanted to sort of reflect for a second on this idea of Niagara Falls, this sort of unstoppable torrent. One of the things that Dan had written about in his book and came up often in our conversations was, you know, something that I often reflected upon, which was all of the cultural forces in position to control women's sexuality. And I guess it's sort of a feminist device in some way to sort of turn that on its head and say, well, why so many checks and balances and attempts to control? If female sexuality is such a muted, docile phenomenon, why would we need to be so strict in the rules that women are supposed to follow with how they dress, how they comport themselves, how they are taught about their sexuality? You know, ostensibly, if women are not going to have a torrent like the Niagara Falls of sexual desire, mm-hmm. What does it matter if it's teaching them to masturbate? Inherently, they shouldn't want to do it if that's the nature of their sexuality. And so, you know, part of the work that I do is really about approaching this topic from a different perspective and in some way sort of looking into those corners and asking questions that have, I think, to this point been ignored.
Well, Meredith Shivers, it's been great to have you on Radio Times, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. It's been great.
It's been great for us as well.
Thanks, Ben.
You're welcome. Yeah.
Thank you, Meredith.
We're going to take another short break, get back to our conversation. Daniel Bergner staying with us for the rest of the hour. Meredith Shivers, a clinical psychologist, associate professor at Queen's University, and Daniel Bergner, author of this new book called What Do Women Want? And it's subtitled Adventures in the Science of Female Desire. And Meredith Shivers, one of several researchers that he interviewed for the book. I do want to pick up on her response to our caller's question after this very short break. An adult conversation. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Hamilton Public Media Commons Young Journalist Summer Camp is back at WHYY. Students in grades 9 through 12 will create video news stories and learn from award-winning journalists and media professionals, interviewing, shooting and editing video, and more. Two-week sessions starting August 5th. RSVP at whyy.org/camps. And young movie makers can submit entries for WHYY's Youth Media Awards now. Visit whyy.org/awards to learn more.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with David Gilbert about his new novel, Anne Sons. At the center of the story is a reclusive novelist who, like Salinger, has a special place in the hearts of readers, especially those who read him when they were young. But the writer's sons don't feel that connection. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Detroit says we're bankrupt, and the message to thousands of possible pension holders is, never mind.
You made a promise. You know, you just can't say, forget about that.
The promise and paradox of pensions in 21st century America facing a new economic reality. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Daniel Bergner. Decided to look for the answer to the question that has confounded men, and probably some women as well, for many, many years now. What do women want? He talked with behavioral scientists, psychologists, sex researchers, women themselves, and what he found challenges some of the stereotypes about women caring more about connection and security and cuddling than being sexual initiators, even aggressors. His book is called What Do Women Want? Adventures in the Science of Female Desire. And as I have said several times during this hour, bears repeating, this is an adult conversation. There's so many things to pick up on, Dan, but let me get back to you. And one of the things that you had mentioned earlier is a kind of fear that you think men or perhaps even society have had about women's actual sexuality.
Yeah, I mean, I've had that in responses to my book. The first friend, writer, husband, who I gave galleys to, said, this is a cause of deep concern. Another friend said, this scared the bejesus out of me. I don't think it need to actually instill fear, but certainly a level of trepidation, because we men prefer, to put it simply, to think that while our eyes and thoughts might roam a bit, our partner's eyes and thoughts are largely focused on us. And this has all kinds of then more profound ramifications. So one place I ran up against this fear was as I followed the story of the development of a so-called female Viagra. So ever since billions were made on the male version, drug companies have been chasing the female version. It's important to point out that term female Viagra is a bit of a misnomer, because really while Viagra works on the mechanics, very simple in the end in its effects, the female version is really trying to create access to desire, create an easier sort of path to desire. And so it is those attempts, those prospective drugs are kind of tinkering with the neurotransmitters. So when I wrote that chapter, it gave me a chance to talk about two fascinating things. One was just the neurology of desire, to get inside the head and talk about what's going on when we want sexually. But the other thing that was both funny and staggering to me was that as drug companies approached their goal, they worried about their results being possibly too strong. If their results were too strong, would the FDA turn them down for fear of creating a world of nymphomaniacs? Well, that's laughable on the one hand, but it is indicative that conversation was going on is indicative of this fear of women's sexuality that simply doesn't exist about male sexuality. We take for granted males get to be animals, go out there, you know, chase. And I didn't hear such fear. I don't think we had any fears about Viagra, the male version, when it was being researched.
What do you make of the fact, and this is sort of generally speaking, is and perhaps this comes from older women and perhaps even women in long-term relationships, a lack of sexual desire. And I wonder whether there isn't the sort of stranger or the romantic interlude or the sexual adventure that might keep someone interested.
Right. Well, I think the allure of the stranger is something we talk about all the time when it comes to men, and very much more rarely when it comes to women. But a really striking study that I ran up against a pair of studies that looked at 2,500 couples, so no small number and probably not a fluke in the results. It was fascinating. Male and female desire within the committed couple started about the same level, so no issue of women being somehow less libidinous. Male desire declines gradually over time. Women's desire within those relationships seems to decline quite steeply. So again, turning assumptions upside down about what women and men want.
Well, and one could think, you know, there's house I'm thinking of all the reasons, house cleaning, children. I mean, perhaps some of these men are not the best lovers in the world.
All absolutely true. But I'm going to be blunt here and say this. I think all those reasons, house cleaning, children, et cetera,
right,
might be excuses a bit, might be reasons that sort of soften the blow for everyone, soften the blow for that male partner that is no longer wanted, soften the blow to women herself or themselves about what's going on. And really, you know, as I told the stories of individual women and threaded those through the book, I came up against this again and again and really sort of started to feel that the assumption that women would somehow be more suited to monogamy really was a kind of burden. Like this one woman, Isabel, around 30, comes to mind. She was wrestling with, kind of tormented by the decision of whether to marry her boyfriend, long-term boyfriend, attractive, adoring, just perfect on paper, but she'd lost her desire for him, and I think she couldn't think past that. That sort of clouded her mind in some way, and she felt that she was failing this standard, and that prevented her from kind of, I don't know, thinking through things clearly. And certainly I'm not arguing, wouldn't expect her to toss away her monogamous relationship. I'm not tossing away my monogamous relationship. I'm way too romantic for that, but I do strongly believe that a more candid conversation about sexuality between men and women might lead to some good places, might bring some electricity back into our committed relationships.
Some of the quotes a little bit depressing here. The pleasure that having sex, one woman says, having sex with my husband was like the pleasure of returning library books. My husband feels like my brother. It's, ouch.
I know. There is a bit of an ouch factor, especially for us men, again. You know, certainly I don't mean to be painting an overly gloomy picture. Number one, another danger here is that I sound like I'm making pronouncements about all women. I did want to challenge some widespread assumptions, but as my previous book certainly testifies, I do fully recognize that book is all about our human variation sexually. But again, I do think that there's this expectation placed upon women that is very much misguided. And here's the thing. Imagine that the energy that we men are encouraged to feel sexually out in the world and that we then bring back into our committed relationships in a way, because all of that electricity, that erotic energy comes sort of back home in a sense. Imagine if that were equally allowed and encouraged for women. I wonder if that wouldn't create a kind of electrical charge that right now we're dampening, we men are dampening, really out of a feeling of threat.
Let me get back to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. Looks like we have Dr. Pooja Lakshan. Go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hi, thank you, Marty. My name is Dr. Pooja Lakshman. I'm a psychiatrist, and I'm doing neuroscience research on orgasm at Rutgers. And Daniel, I love your work. I think it's so important, and as well Meredith's work. My question, and you actually answered it, my question was about the female Viagra and kind of what are the implications for that and how can we bring this back to actually a natural modality. I also do a practice called orgasmic meditation. And I guess I'm wondering what your thought is about communication between men and women and how that ties in to relating sex and desire and what the disconnect there is.
Thanks for the call. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, of course, communication is something that gets talked about all the time. And so I want to sort of separate out two threads here. One is the old idea, not a bad one, that intimacy is crucial, emotional intimacy, emotional closeness crucial to our sexual relationships. I'm all for that. But again, I want to be careful because our old assumptions have said women particularly need emotional closeness in order to feel erotic electricity. And I think that fits with that old evolutionary psychology paradigm of men promiscuous, women seeking out one good man, women being more monogamous. I'd like to be really careful about that and say, I'm not sure there's a whole lot of evidence to support it. And in fact, to go back to Marta Mayana, who I mentioned earlier, she would say, you know, you can try and try and try as a therapist with couples to create a sexual, to revive lust through the pathways of emotion, and it is going to be a frustrating journey. That's on the one hand. Let's talk about a different kind of communication, a more blunt and candid communication about sexuality. I think that were that happening, were I, for instance, willing to listen to my partner's fantasies and truly listen and maybe ask the questions five times because it may take that long to get through our kind of cultural barriers and her fears about hurting my fragile ego, were we really able to have that kind of candid conversation, I think that would be very meaningful to our sexual lives.
Thanks for the call. Let's see what Susanna from Center City, Philadelphia has to say. Susanna, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I'm a practicing clinical sexologist in Philadelphia, and when I recently conducted focus groups for my preliminary PhD studies, went to school later on in life, and my PhD is in human sexuality, I noticed women distinguished verbally between being turned on physically for sex and emotionally for sexual desire, and that's further divided down into desire for sex in general and desire for sex with a specific sexual partner. The quantitative studies, I believe, do not take into account these verbal distinctions. They assume physical turn-on from photostimulus equals turn-on for sex, period. And this could create a skewed conclusion.
Well, let me see what Daniel Bergner has to say.
You know, I think Meredith Chivers, who's done a lot of research about that distinction between the physical response and the sort of psychological or subjective response, was saying earlier that it's important not to equate the physical response with desire, but nevertheless also important to take into account that physical response, and that the difference between the two is really what's so fascinating. And sort of beginning to think about that, seeing that alongside Meredith, having endless conversations with her about it that, you know, continue right on up to really this morning, is part of, I think, what scientists, what therapists, you know, what everyday women will be contemplating as part of really understanding the way that desire works.
Susanna, thanks for the call. And perhaps this is a question to Meredith, who is no longer with us. But would you say, I mean, the laboratory is different from the bedroom?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a different environment, different relationships, different people, obviously.
Of course. And there's always going to be that problem. It's very difficult to go into the bedroom with a bunch of apparatus and start measuring genital response, though I suppose you could. Masters and Johnson tried to film and sort of calibrate sexual response right there in the lab during, you know, sexual acts. So there are always going to be limits to what scientists can tell us. And I guess that was what was so, sort of gratifying to me as I spent time on the book, was the ability to spend time both with scientists and with individual women, kind of hearing the intimate voices and then hearing the scientific ones.
Let me get Margaret from Concordville to join us on Radio Times. And Margaret, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Boy, did that lady, second caller ago, orgasmic meditation? Like, oh, man, I got to Google that. Anyway, I'm 70 years old. I still have shameful feelings about high school experiences. And I think even today they affect me sexually. So my question is, you know, how do I talk positively with my 14-year-old granddaughter so that she'll have a healthy outlook it frightens me. You know, I want to say, you know, I don't think anything's changed. I still think you'd be a, and she goes, S-L-U-T? And I said, yeah. She goes, no, hasn't changed.
Right. Well, first of all, Margaret, it's good that you want to talk with your granddaughter and you want to give her a positive message. Let me see what our guest, Daniel Bergner, has to say.
Yeah, first of all, I'm moved by the candor of your question, moved by the honesty of your own exploration. You know, I have a daughter who's just about to turn 21, so it's not so long ago that I and her mother were facing the questions that you are. And I think, first of all, honesty, great. And your own, an expression of your own regret or sadness, if that's the right word, over, you know, the limitations of your own experience or shame around your own past experience, I think is a good way to start. You know, when in doubt, be honest about what you yourself have been through, and I think that'll go a long way toward lifting that S-O-U-T burden, which, yes, first of all things needs to be lifted.
Margaret, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. About a minute before we have to say goodbye, so what do women want?
I wish I had one overarching answer. Of course I don't, and it would be just, you know, a disservice to everyone to offer one answer. I hope what will happen is people will read the book. I think it's a fast read and a fun read and a fascinating one, and that they'll put it down and that then men and women will start a new kind of conversation that will lead us to more understanding about who we are as human beings.
There's a personal question, but is writing these books, and you've written a book about desire before this, has that led to a what, better relationship with your wife?
I hope so.
As I said, a very personal question.
Well, it's a better relationship with my partner, let's say, because we're not married, but we've been together for several years. And I think so. It's led to certainly a lot of jokes between us, a better understanding. And but leaving jokes aside, it has really led to a lot more candor, and I think that leads to great places.
Well, Daniel Bergner, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. The book is called What Do Women Want? And it's subtitled Adventures in the Science of Female Desire. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, and Debbie Builder with Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for those phone calls, and thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.